Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West with a handful of guests, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 63 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday, Larry. I hope it's not freezing cold where you are.
It is not. It's a balmy 94 degrees here.
Balmy 94? 94?
No, probably in the 50s earlier today, but it's colder now since the sun has gone down.
Well, we have Josh joining us tonight, and Josh is up in Michigan, and he took off his sweater just a little while ago because it must be like above 50 below zero, so that just makes it like t-shirt weather. Hey, Josh, how are you?
Hey, Andy, it's actually pretty nice today. It's a little chilly, but not much.
But not like 50 I'm below good. With wind chill?
No, that was last week.
That was some crazy weather. Well, so you are from the Decarceration Nation podcast. You've written a book. You are like a 1,000 per week Twitterer. Or how do you verb Twitter?
I have no idea. Tweeter, yeah. Twitter, and, whatever.
And you are a resident expert on Michigan, and some kind of sort of like hot publication came out, I guess, from the attorney general up there. So I wanted to have you on so that you could speak first person about that whole situation.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Cool. I'm here.
So what other kind of like stuff can we talk about, Larry, before we actually get things rolling?
Oh, have I done anything crazy in the last week?
Yes, pretty much. Have you changed out any shower heads? Have you had any outbreaks of flooding? Have you figured out how to park your car yet?
I've not changed any shower heads. I haven't traveled, so that has not been necessary. I have not figured out how to drive the car yet, so I'm still driving the old one. And I have actually flooded my house just a couple days ago. So
flooded to what degree? Like a leak? Like swimming pool?
Well, this is the most laughable thing that anybody can ever imagine. Anyone. I've only been tolerating this for like 6 years, so I'm going to get around to fixing it one of these days. But
so it's a new problem, though.
Well, I wouldn't call it new if it's been since like 2011. As I said, it'd be like 7 or 8 years now. So I have what's built as a slab house. And those of you who don't know what slab houses are, that's where they, rather than having a crawl space, they're on a cement slab. Or as I said, the Beverly Hillbillies, cement. And all your piping and everything is under that slab. If you have any problems, you have to break the slab. And so in the 80s, when this place was built, they were using a product called polybutylene piping. And it turned out not to be a very durable product, and it springs pinhole leaks, which become larger and larger. And there's been a number of them. But the beautiful thing about polybutylene is you can put a smaller pipe inside that pipe, so it doesn't make hard 90-degree turns. You don't have joints. They just lay it across the ground, and it follows the curvature, and then turns up in the wall, and it feeds your fixture. So I've been sleeving all these leaks. Well, I've got one now that I can't find, and it's not easy to sleeve. So what you do in a case like that is you put a shutoff valve so you can turn that water off when you're not using it. Well, I went home a couple nights ago, and I turned it on and forgot about it. In a matter of a couple of hours, it builds up enough water under the slab that it starts oozing up through the slab. So all of a sudden, I have water coming in my garage.
I have an important question for you, Larry. Does that mean once it all leaked out that you had a cement pond?
Well, it wasn't that much water. It's interesting when water's on your floor, you can take a cup of water, a glass of water, and dump it on the floor, and you think you've got lots of water. You really don't. When I scooped it and got it all up, I think I probably hauled out maybe 8 gallons of water. But when that's all spread across your garage floor, you think you've got a flood. And so try getting up 8 gallons of water when it's all spread across the floor, and try to corral that with a dustpan with a nice smooth edge, or with a string mop, and try to see how many times you have to wring out your mop to get up 8, 9, 10 gallons of water. And let me know how long it takes. If you don't have a wet vac, you're going to be picking up water for a while. So that's my excitement for the week.
I was just trying to make a pile on the Beverly Hillbillies joke there, but
the cement pond. Yes, I didn't have I didn't have enough water to have a cement pond. So, but yes, I'm familiar with that cement pond.
Well, let's get rolling. And first up, we had a question from a patron in Wisconsin, Dave, and he had a pretty long question about GPS and the state Supreme Court. And Dave writes, "Hi, Andy and Larry. As you know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court recently decided that lifetime GPS is not punishment. Then shortly after that, another case went to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals where it was decided that it is not unconstitutional to apply lifetime GPS retroactively. If GPS isn't punishment and it can be applied retroactively, what's to prevent it from being part of the registration process? If I understand correctly, the way our laws are now, not just anyone can be given GPS monitoring. You would need to violate conditions of supervision or be convicted of a new crime. But why not require all Wisconsin registrants to wear GPS? It's for the public safety, after all. I understand the concept of trying to prevent bad law by presenting facts to a committee of legislators. If a new bill is introduced that would require more registrants to wear GPS, it could hopefully be stopped in committee. But what happens once a state Supreme Court makes a ruling? Does the next case go to Circuit Court of Appeals? Also, in hindsight, could anything have been done to sway members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court into deciding differently? Sorry about the length of the question. This GPS thing is really on my mind. As always, thank you for an excellent show you guys are doing." Wow. Dave, for the long question.
Well, it would be a series of questions. We could actually do a program on this, which I think I might recommend that we do a program about this, a whole episode on the our feature event. There's so many questions in here. And I have not read. That case came out in mid-2018. I skimmed it in show prep today, but I didn't really digest it to the level that would be where I could be the best helpful. But I can tell you some things I spotted right away. And that was, it's all important about how a case comes before the court, the vehicle that you're riding. And people don't understand that. They think that when you're in court that you file something and the court figures out what it is. And no, you don't just file a thingy. You file a particular thingy that has a name, whether it be a petition for a dissolution of marriage, whether it be a petition for restitution of your property if you're a landlord, whether it be a petition for revocation of probation supervision if it's the state, you know, whether it be a criminal complaint alleging. There's all these different pleadings, and each type of action has a different process and a different set of rules, different standards of evidence, and different evidence taking and gathering rules for the evidence that go forward. He filed a motion to withdraw his plea because he alleged that since they failed to apprise him of that GPS monitoring requirement, that he should be allowed to withdraw his plea. Well, the requirements for being able to withdraw a plea, since I don't have any associate practices in Wisconsin, I've never associated with an attorney and had to work on that issue, I can't tell you what the exact standards are in Wisconsin. Withdrawing a plea is very, very, very difficult unless you have an agreement in advance, and that's universally federal or across the country. Withdrawing a plea, that's why they ask you all those questions that you don't like being asked about. Do you understand English language? What grade did you attend in school? Are you under the effect of any medications today? Has your attorney explained all the rights you're giving up? You have the right to do this, and they go down a whole litany of things. They don't do that lightly. They do that to make sure that that door is shut behind you. And I can assure you that he probably answered all those questions. He understood all these things. And what it come to find out, he didn't understand this because it wasn't explained to him. He didn't know about it. Well, then in order not to have an avalanche, what the court would have been considering is that we don't want to do anything to encourage people to use this vehicle of withdrawing pleas. Next thing you know, we'll have hundreds, and they worry about the proverbial floodgates. So they would have said, wow, we're going to have a deluge if we let this guy out of his plea. There's no telling how many of these cases are out there. So they went into this looking for a way to make sure that his plea stood. Well, how do you get there? Well, they decided to use the intent effects test to say that, well, GPS in and of itself isn't really punitive. And they went through the traditional analysis of what's punishment, which is imprisonment. And they went through a list of things that constitutes punishment. Fines, they said, well, it's not a fine. It's not incarceration. It's not restrictions on his movement. He can go anywhere he wants to. It's just that where he goes is tracked, but it doesn't say he can't. I mean, we don't say anything. That's not punishment. So therefore, they upheld it. But you've had so much upheaval in Wisconsin in terms of the Supreme Court, in terms of when Walker got to be governor, there were some vacancies, and I don't know all the history on this. The listener probably knows better than I do, but I know Walker ended up, former governor Walker ended up appointing a couple of justices to the Supreme Court. And there was some consternation about whether he was meddling with the court or what he was doing. And I don't know all the intricacies of that. But I do remember that judges are elected except for when there are vacancies. So the justices you've got on the Supreme Court, they're elected for like long periods of time. You know, it's like 8 or 10 years. It's not a short tenure that they serve. And they structured that deliberately to make sure that the political winds didn't blow too hard against the judiciary was somewhat insulated from the whims of politics. But this was an example of a court wanting to get to the answer that they wanted to get to because he was bringing a petition to withdraw his plea. If he'd have brought a different type of action, where you could build an evidentiary record about how punitive GPS was rather than just trying to do a straight motion to withdraw his plea, it's possible he might could have got a different outcome. No one knows. But so that's my take on it. And does this go to the Court of Appeals? No. I mean, when he's talking about is the next step. The federal courts do not automatically have jurisdiction over state courts. They're not the superior court of the states. The federal courts are actually courts of limited jurisdiction. You can only take an issue to federal court if there's a federal claim that you want to assert. So there's no automatic
something like appeal. A constitutional violation, right?
Right, right. Theoretically, he could make a constitutional assertion here that the state Supreme Court got it wrong and that does constitute punishment, and he could go into federal court. But there's no automatic that would be a place where he could go because there's nowhere else to go in the state if once you've exhausted the state Supreme Court, unless they want to reconsider their opinion. That's the end of the gigs. So he would have to go to federal court, but he has to have a cognizable claim to go into federal court. Just because you don't like what your state court decided, that's no basis to go into federal court because the federal courts are limited in what they can hear.
That is a lot of, I'm just going to say it this way. It's a lot of word salad. That's complicated. I don't mean that in any derogatory way. I mean, that's just a lot of complicated stuff that you just described, and I'm kind of still trying to digest it because, you know, I'm the dummy over here.
Well, that's why I think we should do a program. If we can find a Wisconsin practitioner and bring them in here, I think we could do a much better job of this. But elections have consequences. You got to do the best you can to figure out who you're electing to the Supreme Court. When governors have appointment powers like Governor Walker did, it'd be interesting to look and see of that decision which justices were which way. Matter of fact, I wonder if it's in the decision right now that we have. I've got that. I read it last year.
So what you're describing is when you go to the voting booth, it's not just like it's not a piece of paper handed and it's red or blue and you just colored in.
Elections have consequences.
I see. I've never heard that before.
we need to think about what we're doing when we vote. So on this one, I'm not sure that they even say who voted which way. I'm taking a glance at it. But yeah, I'd like to come back to this one at a future time.
Okay.
It's kind of an interesting topic. I mean, I've always felt like that one of the things that Larry said that we were talking about before the show started was this kind of notion of courts making things true through kind of legal fictions. And I've always thought that all of these kind of safety concern things like GPS monitoring or civil commitment are kind of in that area of things that they created through sort of legal fictions. Like as a person, I kind of feel like with GPS monitoring, the most important thing is that if you're going to say that we're going to provide GPS monitoring because it provides public safety, you should be able to prove that GPS monitoring actually enhances public safety. And to my knowledge, there's no really good research that suggests that. So, you know, a court will say that's not their job, that's the legislator's job to decide if it's true or not. But at the end of the day, I still think it should be true that we should only deprive liberty for reasons that are based in evidence for the most part.
Evidence? That's some poppycock right there.
Well, good poppycock, I hope.
And then moving on, so a person named Christian went to registrymatters.co and left a comment, and it is in reference to a question from a listener from last week about the internet identifiers. And he says, Kentucky's requirement that people on the registry provide internet identifiers was so vague as to be unconstitutional. That was the subject of it. He says, Dear Andy and Larry, a great question last week from the gentleman in Kentucky about not having to provide internet identifiers. If you remember Doe versus Tilly from 2017, this law was struck down by a federal judge citing Kentucky statutes were declared unconstitutional by the trial court. And he gives a link to that. So just wanted to pass that along. He also says that Guy Hamilton Smith actually filed the suit. And keep up the good work. Thank you. Read it, and you will see more in detail. Also, he says, give Larry a hard time for me. I don't know what that's about. So just going to throw that out there.
Well, Christian, thank you. Thank you for actually alerting me to this case. I did not know about it. I did read it in advance of the podcast. And there again, the court, don't overread this case. The court didn't say that you can't collect these. They said that you can't collect them under this statute because there's not sufficient precision. The void for vagueness doctrine is what we talk about, and because the lack of clarity in terms of what had to be collected and how it was collected in the 3-day period, it opened the door to the legislature, if they wanted to go back and address the court's concerns, they could craft a brand new statute and start this merry-go-round all over again. The courts can never prevent lawmakers from making laws.
But then if they start doing that, does that enter into the realm of ex post facto?
How would collecting the internet identifier be? I mean, you can do an ex post facto law as long as it doesn't inflict punishment.
Right.
I read.
It is true that in Doe's versus Snyder, that they did have concerns about the internet identifiers within that case, if I remember correctly.
I don't remember that particular part, but in this particular case, in Doe versus Tilly, the Eastern District of Kentucky, 2017, they were concerned about the collection of the identifiers and the vagueness of how that was drafted, because an offender doesn't know how to comply if you don't write with specific precision. They had social media ban, which was struck. They said that that one was a no-brainer. So the out-and-out ban that Kentucky had on social media, that fell, and it's likely to stay gone. But in terms of the collection, this was the other component of the case. They said that you can't collect these under this statute. They didn't say you can't collect them, period. People always want to hear what's not there. And I'm not advocating for reenacting the law, but I'm telling you that they could go back and narrowly craft a law that gives specific guidance in terms of what they're going, and they start the merry-go-round all over again.
Well, are we ready to start tackling these articles? I have a feeling that we could beat around these articles for a long time, and I'd like to get going so we're not here till
late. Let's do it. And some of them I'm even questioning about who the nut was that put them in here.
Yeah, well, there's only two of them. There's only two nuts involved in this whole thing.
Well, I wouldn't classify myself as a nut, so that only leaves one other.
Okay, so just here's a general question. Chime in if you want to chime in. Does anybody ever think that they're crazy? That is actually crazy. Sometimes people that are sane will say that they're crazy, but do crazy people know they're crazy, but will they tell people that I'm actually crazy?
Yes, they do all the time. I've got a family member that readily confesses that she's crazy.
Do you think that a person that actually is crazy, that is in denial of it, would then, well, obviously they wouldn't profess that they're crazy. So then we're back to, do crazy people know they're crazy?
Some do and some don't.
Right. So possibly the other co-host of this show might actually be crazy and in denial. It's possible.
It's possible. Absolutely.
Just saying.
I've heard of it.
All right. So out of the New York Times, this one's awesome. We cover this subject, and it's kind of goes to the lawsuit that's in Louisiana. And it says, one lawyer, 194 felony cases, and no time. I was trying to look through again while we were talking, and I was trying to find some of the specific numbers of how many hours they say on average it should take a defense attorney to be able to represent someone's cases. And I think the bottom line of this whole story is ultimately that this particular public defender would need 5 years of time to defend the 194 cases that he has on his caseload at the very moment. There's this funny little clip. Go ahead.
If you just do simple math, there's roughly about a little over 200 working days in a year.
Right, right. 2,000 working hours, give or take. Yeah.
So if you break it down to working days, you're counting the personal time off, vacation time, and holidays. Your person's right. going to do a little over 200 working days a year. If you've got 200 cases, that kind of tells you right there, if you're not even a mathematical genius, that you've got 8 hours to meet with your client, review all the discovery, do pretrial interviews, do any witness interviews outside with your experts, going over expert testimony, preparing for trial, conducting the trial, and getting it done. I mean, is that really practical for a public defender to handle 194 cases?
No, you're absolutely right.
There's probably a reason why 95% of cases are plea bargained. I remember when I was being at one of the hearings that I was in, I was standing outside waiting to go in, and I went over to look at the docket, and there were public defenders who had 30 cases in just that day, which was, pretty astounding to me at the time.
Well, there's a picture in the article. There's like a little GIF, whatever, of the attorney. And he's got a bunch of pink slips on his desk there, and they're just strewn everywhere. And he's frantically looking for whatever case, and he's like throwing up his hands in frustration that he can't find the particular docket that he's looking for.
Well,
it's got to be a nightmare.
A reflection on who we are as a society. To think that we've got an obligation. We have this is one of those things where there is a right to counsel. It's been defined for a long time now, what's the early 1960s, I forget the year, but we've got the right. Gideon is like 60 years old, the case. And here we are all these decades later, and we still don't provide resources to people. Now, of the tripod of the justice system, the only one that can't control the caseload is the defense attorney. The defense attorney doesn't decide what's filed. They don't decide what's dismissed, and they don't decide the prosecutor can elect to shrink their caseload by simply not filing. The judge can hold prosecutors to deadlines and dismiss cases that are not moving properly. They don't do it as often as they should. But a defense attorney can only shrink his caseload by doing what? Pleading out the case. That's all they can do to get their caseload. And the cases keep coming.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he has 194 in his docket today, but he's going to go into court tomorrow, and there's going to be 30 new cases to deal with.
And don't forget, there's also the resource disparity between the prosecutors and the defense attorneys, and then the prosecutors also have their own investigation arm, which the defense attorneys obviously are missing as well.
They mentioned that in the article.
It's a great point that they
don't have paralegals. They don't have any additional help.
Well, the expertise of the forensics resources are such a big barrier now. Everything's expert driven today. I mean, there's an expert for every aspect of a case, and the prosecution arm has all those resources because they've got their local police, they've got their local sheriff, they've got the state police, they've got crime lab. On and on of resources. They got the FBI if they need to, and the defense attorney has got his own budget. You know, he or she has to use their own clients' funds or public funds, which are very scarce because the person ought to just plead guilty. The police are overworked already, and they wouldn't have brought the charge if they didn't have the right person. And all they want to do is just to play games with the system and drag this damn thing out. They should just plead guilty and get it over with. They don't need all this expert. This is just a bunch of BS.
There is something. So, let me ask you this question. So then what is the solution? I realize, we could just in this particular case, the guy has five times the caseload. Do we fund the public defender's office fivefold?
I don't think so.
I think in the past, people have suggested equalizing the funds.
I don't think that's the answer, Andy.
Give me an alternate solution then.
Our money is always a component of every problem, and it's interesting because when it's a conservative problem like wanting to fund more cops, they'll tell us when we want more money for schools or anything for social related ills, they say, all you liberal do-gooders, all you think of is more money, and all you want to do is throw more money to problem. Well, that's exactly what they want to do when it comes to military, when it comes to prisons, when it comes to national security and things like that. They want to throw more money at the problem. So magically, money isn't. And I don't think money is necessarily the solution. We've got a systemic problem that's deeper than money. Yes, money would be an infusion to try to bring better quality attorneys into the system and more resources would be a part of the solution. But the bigger part of the problem is that there's a meat grinder that's sucking too many people into the system, and we should find more economical ways to deal with our societal ills than bringing a criminal case against everybody and seeking maximum prison sentences, which is what this administration said it wanted to do when it got elected, was to impose maximum penalties. And that's their words, not mine. I think that we need to look at our failed policies, that we incarcerate at many multiples of the world over in terms of the length of sentences compared to the industrialized, civilized world. And we need to rethink our entire system. So money would be a part of a solution, but there's a bigger problem to solve, and that's our over-prosecution, over-incarceration. That's the bigger part of the problem.
I think the second part of that, the prosecution part, is also important, which is that prosecutors need to stop prosecuting so many cases. We need to make sure that there are more alternatives to incarceration across the board. We need to look for a better alternative than incarceration in almost every instance. And I also think equalizing, I mean, maybe not equalizing fees, but making sure that fees are available is not a bad idea. I also think prosecutors need to provide more. You know, there's also these states where prosecutors are even legally at times allowed to keep information from the defendants, which is a problem too, I think.
Well, all right. So let's move on to this article from the Noonan Times Herald. I think this is like in my my neck of the woods almost.
It is talking indeed. About Andy, it's in a county called Coweta.
Coweta,
the local ones pronounce it Coweta. Now, the people looking at that would probably say Coweta, but if you live there, it's Coweta County, and it's the county seat.
It says LaGrange. Okay, so if it's LaGrange, then it's just north of Columbus, so it's on the west side of the state. But they talk about having these warming centers for these frigid nights that we get here in Georgia, and it's expected to hit 35 degrees at night or 45 on rainy nights. So they're going to open up these shelters for people to get warm. And they go through, they're talking about all these people, like you're going to have air lockable doors for women and children, men staying overnight. They have sanctuary. This is awesome. There's blankets. They're going to do everything. And then it just says registered sex offenders will not be allowed to stay at the shelter. Gotta love it.
Well, what's the problem with that, Andy?
I know, right? Well, this is actually a perfect segue, so we don't have to dwell on this one for very long. But this will be a perfect segue into the next article that we get out of the All Four Cons Laws, which is the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, the California group out there. And so a guy, I guess, not quite in Josh's neck of the woods, but in Springfield, Missouri, he couldn't find shelter. So he froze to death, which is pretty freaking fantastic. Well, you got to love that.
Well, there was one in Michigan also in that same article.
Yes, there was.
In Grand Rapids, Michigan.
But these are horrible people.
Mole stomping grounds, as a matter of fact. That would be Kent County.
I didn't know you had ties. Yeah. Say it, Josh.
I was just going to say, I didn't know that you'd lived in Michigan there, Larry.
I have indeed. I registered to vote with the Secretary of State, and I got my driver's license with the Secretary of State. It's the only place I've ever lived where you went to the Secretary of State's office to get your driver's license. Do they still do it that way?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I said, when I went in, I said, no, I gotta change my license. I said, oh, so where's the MVD? They said, the what? I said, the MVD. And they said, what are you talking about? I said, I need to get a driver's license, for crying out. You people do give licenses up here, don't you? They, oh, yeah, you go to the Secretary of State. I said, you do what?
They said, you go to
the Secretary of State. I said, I thought they registered voters. They said, oh, you get your driver's license. I said, all righty. yes, I did live there back in the early 80s in Grand Rapids. It's a wonderful place to live. It's too darn cold.
Especially for people on the registry who are homeless.
Right. So that takes us to whatever. We had the polar vortex a week or so ago, and it was – I mean, the numbers that they were reporting are just unfathomable to be, 50, 60, 70 below zero with wind chill?
It was damn cold. I'm not going to lie to you. On Wednesday last week, I didn't go out of the house on purpose.
I don't blame you. So you are in a place. You have shelter. If you were out on the street, these are unsurvivable things. I saw pictures on, I guess, Reddit or something. A girl with long hair, she had wet hair, and she goes outside and she like flips it over, and I don't know if it froze instantly or did she hang her head upside down long enough. And then she walks back in the house and her hair is like sticking straight up in the air. It's like 3 feet in the air because her hair is frozen.
Yeah, it's
cold. We won't allow these people a place to live.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had to get on Michigan because I had a pontification I wanted to do.
Well, so, pontificate.
So I actually agree with what the senator said, State Senator Nancy Cassis, I guess that's how you pronounce it. I part of what she said that she supports the registry, the law. I don't agree with that. But then she blames the social safety net for failing Mr. Pauley, who's the one that denied. I agree with her on that. But what I find is ironic about this is that, although I don't know when she is in office, but the social safety net in Michigan has been slowly dismantled over the last few decades. The last they had, when I was there, they had William Milliken as governor, followed by James Blanchard. And after Blanchard left office, they took a hard rightward swing politically. And they've dismantled the social safety net. So, but I'm curious if she was in office, how much participation she had in that dismantling, because they used to have a statewide assistance program called GA that a single person was eligible for. And it would be enough money that you could usually find some kind of rooming and shelter. And they kicked all those able-bodied people off of general assistance, terminated the program. Now the only way you can get any assistance in Michigan is if you have a disability, which is consistent with a lot of other states. And Michigan said that we're attracting too many people here. But I just wonder if State Senator Nancy Cassis feels any regrets for how that the social safety net has been dismantled, and if she would actually like to examine, which I would work with her on, try to reestablish some of those programs that were dismantled back in the 90s, because that is a significant problem. You know, it would still not deal with people who need an emergency shelter, which are denied because of the 1,000 feet, but that's going to go away, or at least be greatly diminished when all this litigation is done on the Doe's versus Snyder, on the Doe's 2 case that's actually pending right now, which we're going to talk about later. But I would hope that she would realize that the social safety net got dismantled because that's what the people of Michigan wanted, and that's what they got.
Josh?
Oh, yeah, I agree with what Larry's saying. That makes a lot of sense to me. And in a couple of weeks, we have a legislative day in Lansing. So if I run into her, I'll ask. Seems like a good question. You said it's the social safety net. What are you doing to fix the social safety net?
Yeah, ask her how she feels about general assistance. And I have a report, and it's an old report. I'll shoot it to you, about what happened to a lot of those people that were on GA. And after they were terminated, some died, some moved out of state, some probably did move in with relatives, some probably even got jobs. I haven't read the report in a long time. But ask her if that was a wise public policy choice, even if she wasn't in the legislature, because Michigan used to have a very good social safety net.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's gotten much worse. You know, last year I was involved in the fight to stop work requirements on Medicaid here. Unfortunately, we lost that battle. We're still dealing with a lot of the restrictions on food aid, including work requirements and a lot of other things. There's not a lot of areas where, you know, and a lot of times, especially for people who are just coming out of prison or jail, the lack of a social safety net as a bridge, if nothing else, is really important. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't qualify. And you end up being in really bad situations. And that's especially true for people on the registry, because as we all know, the discrimination is in a lot of ways worse.
Absolutely. But yes, I've agonized over what Michigan has done in terms of dismantling what was, in my view, a much better state. And you know, so is Wisconsin. I mean, they've shredded a lot of things about Wisconsin that were good, but of course, you know, that's just my opinion as an outsider, but I actually lived in Michigan.
This next article comes from law.com, and the title of it, and Larry, I totally need your help on this one. It says, "Rape Conviction Survives Shield Law Attack." And the subtitle is, "Chief Justice Harold Melton ruled that a trial judge erred by allowing evidence of a victim's prior sexual behavior, even though it was to help win a rape conviction, but the conviction stands."
Well, it was ironic to me because of the, and I would actually need to read the more details on the case, but the rape shield law usually is something that the defense attorney wants to use, and it blocks the defense attorney, because if somebody has a history of making accusations. As a defender, we would think that, well, that's relevant. I mean, this is the seventh time. I mean, this person seems to be the... Well, apparently the prosecutor brought it up, and the appellate court said, well, it was Georgia Supreme Court, but the Georgia Supreme Court said, well, yeah, it was. It shouldn't have been allowed. The prosecutor brought it up, but it didn't really affect the conviction. He would have been convicted anyway. So you can't win. So it's just that the irony of the prosecutor misusing the system, and apparently the prosecutor was able to get away with it, and it worked against the defendant. And the Supreme Court said, well, it doesn't really matter. But it was just the irony that I put it there, and it's from over and where I was born. Alcove Judicial Circuit includes Newton County, Covington. So I thought, well, gee, this is right close to home here.
Right. There was something in there that caught my attention. It says, I would base the court's conclusion in this case on White's failure to satisfy that prong of the 4-part plain error analysis. Do you know what the 4-part plain error analysis is?
I do not.
All right. Well, so, then I will. Then we'll just move on, because that was like my only question of some sort of like legal jargon that we could have covered.
So no, we can bring this up at another date when we know more.
All right. And then, hey, since it's a whole cold theme show, let's talk about a Brooklyn jail to be visited by federal judge after heat and power crisis. I'm sure Josh, you're up on this one.
The judge did visit. So
did he? Okay. So the article goes in to say that you've got a jail, I think over, they say it's on the water, so it's got to be, you know, obviously over on the east coast of New York. And
it's a federal detention facility. It's not actually technically a jail, although they serve the same function.
Yeah. Okay. And it has 1,600 people, and like they're huddled in blankets, and they're just, yeah, it's not good conditions out there. I think they're almost like protesters hanging out, like families and whatnot, trying to protest to get treatment.
Well, there was a fire in the facility that knocked out the electricity right before the polar vortex, and then everyone was basically left there for a week with no electricity in the middle of the vortex. They were on lockdown the entire time, and they had no electricity or heat, and so they didn't allow them to have, except for the blankets that were already in the facility, there was no extra clothes that were given out. And so, yeah, there were several days of protest. Eventually they got it turned back on. But the thing that you'll learn as you read more about, like, when the judge went to visit, is that, you know, this, like most jails in the United States, I mean, for all the time that I talk and everybody talks about the problems in prison, in my personal experience and in most of what I've known, jails are generally even worse than prison, but much less talked about. And, right. You know, for instance, in this particular case, a lot of these people in this detention facility were needing medical care and weren't getting it. The medical care they were getting before this all happened was very bad. For instance, they found a person who had a gunshot wound and wasn't being treated. Because, you know, people come straight in from the street into a detention facility, and just all kinds of, and there was black mold all over the place. And, you know, in the jail that I was in, they had the kitchen closed while I was there for black mold, you know, terrible healthcare situation. So a lot of times when the immediate problem gets fixed, the problem with these stories is this great outpouring of support that happened dissipates because the immediate problem gets fixed, and they forget that the real problems are a lot deeper than just that. Although that was terrible enough. No doubt.
Right. I'm with you 100%. Yeah, we make a big outcry when something like this is super duper egregious, but the daily, it's almost like, you know, how do you boil a frog and you put them in sort of like chilled water and then you just slowly turn up the heat until they eventually wake up dead?
Yeah, that's basically what.
But the status quo of people being detained or in prison is really not very admirable.
Well, and there's a long history at this particular facility of all kinds of problems, from sexual abuse to, like I said, very bad healthcare problems to lots of health problems in general caused by the facility, and a lot of problems with the correctional officers that were happening before any of this happened. And hopefully some of this will spill over, but it does seem like it's already unfortunately dissipated a little bit.
Yeah, sure. It's out of the news cycle. I'm sure we're talking about some sort of border wall or some Trumpism or something or another by now.
Well, it really disappoints me when I hear. I mean, I know there's inadequate jail facilities, but the federal system funding is usually not as critical. They usually have much vaster resources, and to be experiencing that many problems. There's a managerial problem. Now, the power outage or the utility failure is something that, you know, that you don't directly control, but you have backup plans. When you're running a facility, you try to imagine everything that can go wrong. Now, they do that. They try to imagine they have all these SWAT teams and cell extraction teams and have all the dogs and everything. But you also might ought to take into account failures that would affect the human beings that are in there that would you would be responsible for. But it's disappointing to hear that this went on for so long at a federal facility.
Very sad, for sure. You know what's a troubling thing that happens in many of the states?
What's that, Andy?
When you turn 18, you get prosecuted for having a girlfriend that's 15. This one comes from the Miami Herald. They says they dated since he was 15. He turned 18 and now faces 15 years behind bars. This is stupid. I mean, like, what is the difference, literally, other than the legal side of it, between 17 and 364 days and then 18 years old? I can't quite the maturity level hasn't really adjusted much. I can't even. And they're having consensual sex. It doesn't make any sense to me that this kid should go to jail for 15 years whatsoever.
How did this get on the radar of the authorities?
Mom called.
Well, there you
go. Mom knew they were dating for years, and then that's just crazy.
So, yes, it is.
Well, but see, here's what happens. Now, I'm not trying to play devil's advocate, but here's what happens. There are people who advocate on behalf of victims of sexual exploitation. And they come into the legislature and they say, can you believe there's adults out there having sex with our kids? And of course, they don't bother to tell you that they're talking about people that are just 18 years old by virtue of being a chronological day. And they're having sex with our minor kids. And that's an exploitation of children. And we ought to make it illegal for adults to have sex with children. Then you don't have anybody on our side there when they're debating the law that says that it's exploitation of children to say, well, wait. When you and I were in school, that we actually had sex, and it was a status symbol to have sex with someone who was older because they could get alcohol and they had a car or whatever the things that made it statusy. And we did that, and we're going to be putting a lot of people in jeopardy if we do that and we don't put a gap of 4 or 5 years between there. So no one raises the question, and they pass the law not knowing any better if nobody brings up the issue and nobody says anything, and they end up with a law like this. If you were to research Florida law, you would probably find that at one time there was a gap. But people said, we don't need these adult men having sex with teenage girls, and we got to do something about that, by golly. And that's how the law got there without the gap, just about bet you.
Sounds fair.
Yeah, it seems like one of those things where judicial discretion should still exist. You know, like if someone has been dating someone since they were 15, and they turn 18. I mean, I understand what you're saying too, Larry, but this particular case seems uniquely absurd to me.
Oh, now
Andy said, the one day difference really shouldn't have made, it shouldn't be a 15-year sentence, you know?
Now I got to push back on that. Now, so you want a judge to tell the prosecution that even though that law is on the books, that it says that it's against the law and it's a felony in the state of Florida, you want a judge wearing a robe to usurp the power of the people that they've validly and duly enacted a law and say, I'm going to throw this case out of court because you ought not be prosecuting that. You want a judge to do that?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Well, I will absolutely guarantee you that the general public does not want judges deciding what laws are enforced.
Well, in this case, the general public is wrong.
So
there's a reason why we have a tyranny of the majority argument. There's a reason why it's not a purely majoritarian system.
So, I mean, wouldn't that be a great system if a judge could say, I don't feel too, this is not such a, I don't really think I care for this law. Case out of here.
Well, you're right. The law, well... Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I'm just saying it's a bad law.
That
sometimes the absurd cases are what prove something's a bad law. This would be one of those examples.
But this is an example where I get to say a bad law is not necessarily an unconstitutional law. In a confirmation hearing, I believe it was Sotomayor, or maybe it was Kagan, but one of them said that a bad law is not necessarily unconstitutional. This is an example of a bad law. Yes.
Well, let me push back on your pushback, because prosecutors always get to choose whether to enforce the law or not. So why are you opposed to judicial discretion but not prosecutorial discretion?
Oh, well, that's absolutely. I agree with prosecutorial discretion. They have that discretion to choose to bring a case.
But the law says they should bring a case, but that's still their discretion to choose to do it or not, because they've seen the facts and they think one is more likely than the other, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What's the difference?
And the difference is it's not the judge is a neutral party. The judge is not to determine what the people want prosecuted. The people elected their prosecutor in almost every jurisdiction in this country. The people made the decision to entrust a particular person to decide which laws to prioritize and which to prosecute. The judge, being a neutral referee, is supposed to referee that fight and not tell the prosecutor, I don't like your choice.
But you will at least admit that the prosecutor is overriding the legislature when they don't prosecute cases that are legally mandated.
I would say, I wouldn't put it quite in those terms. I would say a prosecutor that uses their discretion hopefully is allocating resources. Now, this is an idealistic, because I know that sometimes they're doing it for political purposes, but you could not possibly prosecute everything that law enforcement sends to you. There's no prosecutor office that has enough resources, even with their overstaffing, to prosecute everything. So you do develop criteria and you develop grid systems and you look at certain ways of how you do intake, and cases work their way through and they decide this is a no-go and this is a go. The evidence, how strong the evidence is. There's a number of decisions goes into prosecuting, but it's not the judge's decision. The judge is supposed to referee the fight.
That was kind of my point, is though that the whole point of having a judge be neutral is because they check the tyranny of the majority. And so judicial discretion serves a similar function.
Don't agree with you there. The judge doesn't get to toss out a case. If it's a valid law, and the prosecutor wants to bring it forward, that's not the judge's decision.
All right, we'll agree to disagree a little bit. I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I think there's a little bit there with why the judge actually does.
The judge can say a counsel approach. Do you really want to go forward with this? But if the prosecutor says yes, the judge is supposed to say okay. It's your call, Mr. Prosecutor. Right. It's your call. And the judge can tell the prosecutor, I can't imagine that a court's going to sentence this person to prison, even if you convict him. But still, you got all the collateral consequences that go with a felony conviction and the registration that follows. It's a horrible thing to do to subject. But the people in the state of Florida need to fix that law so that there's a protection for people who are reasonably related in age. That's the solution, not to have judges arbitrarily decide that they don't want the law enforced.
Well, we agree that there should be a change to legislation for sure.
Absolutely. We agree on that.
Then this one comes from a place I don't think we've ever covered it before. It's called Roll Call. And there's not a lot that we can actually cover, because it's a podcast with a woman named Patricia Hill, calls herself a feminist and a liberal Democrat. But the title is Me Too Reconsidered, One Feminist on Equalizing Campus Sexual Assault Rules. I listened to it, and her point is, one thing that I took away from listening, is that she absolutely believes, very much like Larry would say, is that there has to be a due process. There has to be that, confrontation. You have to be able to interrogate both parties to vet out their story to see if there's like legitimacy in it. You can't just say the woman is either to be believed or not. You have to figure out if there's substance behind it. You have to do that in some kind of court setting-ish thing.
That's the way I feel about it. And I'm glad, the reason why I threw it in there is because I generally have not a lot of good things to say about them, but someone who's in that movement saying, whoa, I mean, we still have to have due process. I appreciated that. So I threw this article in there we got a lieutenant governor now being accused in the great state of Virginia. But he's entitled to a little bit of due process, don't you think?
I would think so.
Well, I think, this time I really am playing devil's advocate. I think there's a difference between legal due process and the court of public opinion or your job, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. He is going to be diminished in public opinion, and it's going to be very difficult for him to do the job whatever those duties are in our state, he would preside over the legislature when they're in session, preside over the Senate more than the legislature. But there would be ceremonial rules that would be very, very difficult. So he has to decide whether he wants to try to continue to hold that job. But there should be no rush for us to assume that he's guilty. We're talking about something that happened a long time ago, if it happened at all. And now I did hear there was some evidence that she did, at the time he announced his first election for office, not for lieutenant governor, but the first time he was running, that she did, one of the accusers did say that, did make an accusation a long, long time ago that this guy, you know, don't contact me for, he contacted all the alumni. And she said, don't contact me ever again. You're a creep, you know, this, that, and the other. So there is at least a shred of evidence that's contemporaneous with the time.
Yeah, I hate the public's. Oh, go ahead, Andy. Sorry.
Well, I was going to bring up that I find it is very interesting that with you know, the Al Franken accusation, and it's, you know, so then he steps out and all these other ones, that what is now possibly about to happen in Virginia, which is kind of humorous, is that the top three people, the only statewide elected officials are the top three. So the governor, the lieutenant governor, and I forgot, what's the other position?
The attorney general.
Okay, so the attorney general. Those are the only three Democrats, and if they all three step down for these various social breach of contracts, if you want to call them that, then the next person up would be a Republican. So then would the Democrats want to actually, like, clean house and let the other party step up to the plate? It's kind of an interesting situation that they're going to have to play a little bit different, because in Minnesota with Al Franken, when he stepped down, then the governor could just appoint another Democrat. So it wasn't a change in the balance of power, but this could ultimately be a change in the balance of power.
Well, the question would be, and I don't know the answer to it, the question would be, if a vacancy springs up in the lieutenant governor's office in Virginia, is there a process to fill that vacancy? Because if there is, then the governor, Northam, would just hold on to power until there's a lieutenant governor fill through that process. And then if he ends up being toppled, then the lieutenant governor would go in. So the logical way would be that the lieutenant governor would step aside if there is a process. If that office stays vacant, then that creates a new problem. But, you know, at the federal level, I can remind people that are too young or weren't paying attention. In 1973, we had that very problem in the United States. Watergate erupted in the summer of 72 with the break-in Democratic National Headquarters. And then Watergate was going pretty strong by 73. We had a resignation of the vice president, Spiro T. Agnew, if anybody remembers that name. And when Agnew resigned, that created a vacancy in the vice presidency. Well, the president was in great peril by 73. So the question became, what do we do with the vice presidency? Can someone be confirmed? Because without the vice president being confirmed, then you would have had a switch of power, because the next in line of succession would have been the Speaker of the House, who was a Democrat from Oklahoma named Carl Albert. And so Carl Albert could have, if he had been of the mindset of people are today to keep things vacant, he could have just thrown a monkey wrench in any of the confirmation process that went forth in 73 to confirm the nomination of Richard Nixon, which was House Minority Leader Gerald Ford from Michigan, from Grand Rapids, as a matter of fact. So that process was allowed to work, and there was a replacement put in. Gerald Ford was confirmed, and then he ascended to the presidency in August of 1974. Well, if there's such a process in Virginia, that would be one way. But if there is no such process, I can assure you that those three people are not going to voluntarily step aside and hand over, right, surrender the power of the state to people who were not elected. But the confirmation went smoothly, and Ford was confirmed almost unanimously in both the House and the Senate. It took a supermajority, and he was resoundingly confirmed because he was very well respected on both sides of the aisle. But I'm not sure that would happen today.
Well, to return back to your original question, when you know, Andy, when you were asking me about what I, you know, flesh it out a little more, what I mean is, like, for instance, when I was arrested, I was given the choice by my employer to resign or they would fire me. Not much, yeah, of a choice, sure. But yes. But that still is different than legal due process. I had not been found guilty or innocent in my case yet. They just, you know, because, you know, and businesses can do that. There's a difference between due process, which is a legal process, and the way your employer or public opinion, you know, decides that you're, you know, how you should be adjudicated. You know, I mean, it sucks. I mean, I think obviously way too often, especially with a lot of these situations that we're talking about now, the rush to judgment is fast. But that's, you know, that's like the idea of due process writ large, not due process, the legal process, which is really what someone has a right to.
And then, Larry, to backtrack, you have just an unbelievable depth of knowledge that just doesn't even make any sense that why somebody would know those things.
Well, why wouldn't they? Doesn't everybody know those things?
No, I've heard the name Spiro, whatever, Agnew. I didn't realize he was the vice president. And then, I'm lost.
Well, I've assumed everybody out there would listen to us will know who Spiro Agnew is.
I've heard the name.
So, yes. Well, I agree with Josh partially about due process. But Josh, how would you feel if the due process had related to conduct on the job? And if the employer said, we don't care about your due process, we don't have any here. The accusation is that you put your hand where it didn't belong, you're out of here. I know we live in the world the way it is, be not the way it should be, but are you comfortable?
I wasn't saying that it was right. I was saying that's factually the way it works. You know, I was talking about the world that we have, not the world that we should have. I agree with you that I don't think any of these things are great and that the public rushes to judgment. And it would be nice if we at least figured out if we had the facts right before we, you know, basically ran someone out of office or whatever.
Well, I'd just like to be consistent with what we're taking as a posture for the current administration at the federal level. The posture they're taking is that anything that happened prior to the presidency is off limits. We can only impeach and remove for a conduct that occurred on presidential time. So I would like to adhere across the board to that. If the lieutenant governor engaged in sexual misconduct, he certainly is not being accused of it yet since he's been in office for the 16 days or so that he's been in office since January 19th. So what is that, 30 days? Not even 30 days, 20 days. He hasn't been accused of any misconduct on the job. So without an accusation of misconduct on the job, then we revert back to what the due process is in the case of a crime. The people elected the guy. They elected him not that long ago. And therefore, I think he gets to stay on the job until he's at least indicted for a crime.
I do think it is it's important to note that almost all the same people who are asking for large due process for Justice Kavanaugh are the same people, a lot of the same people who are asking for these people to be, you know, basically thrown off the job. So
that's the point I'm making. And it's the same people who are saying that we can't touch the president unless we have misconduct in office. Okay, I bought into your strategy. I always like to buy in people's philosophy. If we can't touch somebody unless he did it in office, I agree. So let's don't touch this guy until misconduct surfaced while he's in office or until he's at least charged with a crime. There's a prosecutor who finds that there's enough evidence, which it doesn't take much in a sexual case. All it takes is a person saying so. But until he's at least charged with a crime, I would say convicted of a crime, maybe I have a personal preference, but he hasn't been charged with a crime yet. And we're ready to dump him out of the job that the people elected him to do 3 months ago? Doesn't seem quite right to me.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right. And then our penultimate article is from Kentucky, submitted by Mr. Hank up there in, what state? Nebraska? Where three other people
Hank,
live?
Hank. Yeah. Hank. Hank. Thank you, Hank. I always appreciate the contributions.
And this one's kind of fun. It's a Kentucky Supreme Court told voters misinformed on Marcy's Law as to overturn vote. This is a law that's like running around. It's highly funded. It's running around the different states, and 63% of the voters in Kentucky voted. And this is a bill that goes through to give victims more notification than they might already get about their assailant's release, if they've escaped from prison, if they got released from prison, their whereabouts, etc. And as I understand it, like, these mechanisms are already in case. This just makes it more law that they get these extra notifications about their assailant. And but apparently the way that it was on the ballot in Kentucky, that it wasn't necessarily clear in the way that it was worded. It was just like, well, of course we would be in favor of this. So the question asked, are you in favor of providing constitutional rights to victims of crime, including the right to be treated fairly with dignity and respect, and the right to be informed and to have a voice in the judicial process? And so obviously 63% said yes.
I couldn't disagree more. I don't think there, and we talked about this, or I don't believe there is such a thing as victims' rights. I think rights are rights from the power of government in a legal context. And I there's no liberty at stake for a victim. There's only a liberty at stake for the person who's on trial. So for me, you know, that doesn't mean I don't have empathy for people who are victims of crime. It doesn't mean that I don't think that we should care about or take care of or try to protect in all ways aside from the adversarial court process. But I don't think that they have, I don't like the idea of legal victims' rights. I don't think it's constitutional, and I don't think it's correct.
Total blasphemy, Josh. Total blasphemy.
Sorry, Larry.
Yeah, that's it. You're never coming back on this show again. Period.
I thought I was
get off now.
Blasted victim. So now there's two of us. Andy, the difference is that they're putting this in the Constitution. Most of these things are already in Kentucky statute.
Yes.
But the Constitution is far more complicated and difficult to amend. Is it U.S. Constitution, what has it been amended 27 times? State constitutions usually can be amended easier than the federal Constitution, but it's much more difficult. So they're trying to enshrine these statutory requirements into the Constitution. And I do agree with Josh. A victim is a witness in a crime that was committed against the people. And we seem to lose sight of that. We think the crime is against you. No, you're a witness. It's the people who made the rules and structured society. When you break a rule of society, you have slapped the face of the people and said, I don't want to play by your rules. And it's the people who decide what the rules are. It's the people who decide what the penalties are. That way we don't have vengeance. A lot of people, if we left up to them what the punishment would be, there'd be a lot of toothless, eyeless, handless. There'd be a lot of people that would be in a miserable condition, probably dead. That's why we don't leave it up to the individual. We allow that individual to participate in the process. We need their participation, in fact, because they have to be a key witness. But in terms of the crime, it's a crime against the people of the state of Michigan. It's not a crime against you. And the people in the state of Michigan decide what is illegal, what the range of penalties will be, how the process should be adjudicated to keep it fair. And it's not you to decide. But they've interjected the victims in everything. They get to be at the front end. They get to be at the middle end. They get to be at the back end when you're being paroled. They get to come testify if you're going to get off the registry in the states that have deregistration processes. The victims, even in states where it's been declared unconstitutional. I remember in Maryland where the Supreme Court, or their equivalent of the Supreme Court, said twice that the registry is unconstitutional, and the state invented a requirement. They said, well, we're going to notify the victims before we take the people off the registry. What the hell did you do that for? They don't get any say-so. The court has already determined that this law is unconstitutional. Oh, well, we can't remove you until we notify. Really? I think we might have someone from Maryland that was listening earlier that could confirm that. But I said, that is the most bogus stuff I've ever heard in my life, to notify the victims that they're going to be taking the person off the registry. I guess if you were checking the registry, if you were a victim, you would eventually see their name disappeared, wouldn't you?
Right. I wonder, though, in something like this, if it's so traumatic. In the little video clip there, they said that a lady, like, she's in the grocery store, and then you turn the aisle and there's your attacker on the next aisle down. Should, like, I mean, if that is such a traumatic experience, wouldn't it be within the framework of the sentencing to say that you're banished from this county?
Oh my goodness.
I'm not trying to like advocate for that. I'm just trying to like, I mean, people have to coexist. And if the person goes back to the same area that the thing occurred, then there is the chance that you're going to run into the people again.
Yeah, that's,
I know it does, but if it's that traumatic,
I feel like, and that, you know, I definitely have empathy for the situation, but I feel like part of this is that you're, you know, once you're punished, you know, once you're, say, for instance, you go to prison for a crime, you know, you've had essentially a lot of your rights suspended and a lot of bad things have happened to you. You come back. I'm a big believer in that you pay your debt when you serve your, you know, when you serve your sentence. And when you come back, and yeah, accidentally running into someone might be traumatic, but the idea that that person should again have their rights suspended simply after they've served their sentence, simply, you know, I just I don't understand the justification. I understand the emotional justification for it, but I certainly don't understand the constitutional justification for it. As Larry said before we started talking, I don't see that in the Constitution. I don't see that word victim in the Constitution. So to me, I guess I empathize, and I think it sucks for both parties probably. But you know, I personally don't think there's a legal justification for it. I don't know if Larry agrees with that or not.
I do agree. And I want to actually try to get zero in on the question, which I went on that diatribe. The question is that before the court, which is what Hank wants to know the answer to, is the court is actually, if they take if they elect to decide the issue, they're going to decide whether the ballot was sufficiently succinct and clear that the people understood what they're voting on. And I think they will ultimately conclude that it was, because the ballots can't be long enough to contain the full language of constitutional amendments. So you end up with summaries. But what this shows is that the complexities of issues are such that we should not be throwing complicated issues out to the voters to decide, because they just can't understand it. Example would be in Missouri when they debated the what we call Rule 404B, which is propensity evidence and prior bad acts. There was a constitutional amendment put out should prosecutors be allowed to use, the question was essentially, should prosecutors be able to use evidence of prior crimes or something to that effect? Well, what do you think an average person is going to say?
Sure.
They're not going to understand the nuances of 404B, the prejudicial effect. They're probably not going to care even if they do understand. And we already have a balancing act that's done where prior bad acts can be admitted if you can overcome the barriers provided by that rule. And this is an example of why we shouldn't govern by referendum. It was never intended that way. It doesn't work. And I think the Supreme Court of Kentucky is going to be hard-pressed. I hope they come down and surprise me and say that the people overturning the will of the people. But they've got to consider, if they were elected themselves and 63% of the people supported this, and they just simply slapped those 63% of the people in the face, and then they have to face the same people themselves, I just don't think that's going to potentially play out very well for them. So ultimately, I think that if they're elected in Kentucky, that may factor into their deciding it. And that's not the world the way it should be. That's the world the way it is be.
Is be.
Yes. We're going to have to make that the thing. Like, it'll be, you know, whenever this sentence is raised, everyone on the call has to go is be at the same time.
Well, I guess the people throw that to me when I'm having a debate. They'll say, well, that's not the way it should be. And I said, but we don't live in the world the way it should be. We live in the world the way it is. And then I said, well, why not tackle the B? You know, live in the world the way it is B.
we won't include the part about that's not really good grammar, but that's okay.
Yeah, well, of course not. But
you grew up in Georgia, so that makes it okay.
Well, I have, you know, that I grew up at a time when they actually did teach grammar in school. We diagrammed sentences, and we did things that were actually learned how to use a sentence structure and punctuation. I just don't do it enough. You know, everybody these days gets lazy, and I just hand it off to my staff to take care of.
Yeah, but Larry, you also grew up in a time when you used the slide rule in math.
We didn't even have those.
They hadn't been invented yet, right?
They hadn't been invented yet.
Math hadn't been created yet when you were in school.
No, we'd use the abacus.
All right, so
we actually did have the abacus in school. Did you have one?
I have never learned how to use one. I've seen them. I think they are fascinating. It is a very, very, very creative invention that, like, I don't know. What is that, a 6,000-year-old creation? 4,000-year-old creation? That is a very old calculator device. Have you ever seen the videos of, like, the kids? Like, they do speed math on an abacus?
No.
I'll have to go find a video. It's absolutely insane. They have, like, competitions on who can do abacusing. Is that the right word? The fastest... All right, Josh, the reason why you are here is because this this Attorney General amicus, it's not even amicus curiae? How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, you said the second one.
Okay, so curiae. And so this is the brand new elected Attorney General for Michigan, Dana Nessel. Is that right?
Yep, yep.
And this is filed, I guess this is all in response to the class action that's going on up there?
No, it's actually a response to a different case, but it does give us a bellwether for what's going to happen next week in the class action, I think. And I've talked to enough people involved to have a fairly good sense that that's correct. So well,
I did a little recording because I didn't want to read this and like stumble over my words. So here is the introduction from the Attorney General. The tide is changing. For years, federal and state courts consistently held that sex offender registration and notification requirements were not punishments and therefore did not violate the ex post facto clause. Their conclusions relied heavily on the Supreme Court's analysis in Smith v. Doe of 2003 and its conclusion that Alaska's Sex Offender Registration Act was non-punitive. But more recently, both state and federal courts have been rethinking the issue in light of the significant additional burdens that have been added to these statutes since Smith upheld the first-generation registration statute. State Supreme Courts in Alaska, California, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, Maryland, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania have concluded that their registries constitute punishment and their retroactive application an ex post facto violation, either by distinguishing Smith or by relying on their state's ex post facto clause. In 2015, the Sixth Circuit reviewed Michigan's Sex Offender Registration Act, determining that SORA was something altogether different from and more troubling than Alaska's first-generation registry law, and holding that its 2006 and 2011 amendments were punishment and that their retroactive application violated the federal ex post facto clause. The Sixth Circuit cautioned that Smith was not a blank check to states to do whatever they please to do in this arena. Smith's rationale, which was premised on the limited nature of Alaska's registration scheme, seems outdated with respect to modern registration schemes. It surely is with respect to Michigan's sex offender registry, which has changed greatly since its initial character as a tool to help law enforcement keep Michigan citizens safe from dangerous sexual predators, and far exceeds the baseline federal requirement for such registries. It has become a bloated statute whose recent amendments are out of touch with the practical ramifications of its geographic restrictions and in-person reporting requirements, with society's evolving relationship with the internet, with the needs of law enforcement, and with a more balanced and researched understanding of recidivism. But the current SORA, it is not the way to achieve that goal because it places people on the registry without an individualized assessment of their risk to public safety and with little differentiation between a violent rapist or reoffender and an individual who has committed a single non-aggravated offense. The 2006 and 2011 amendments are punishment, and their retroactive application violates both federal and state ex post facto clauses. I wanted to do that to, it's 50-something pages, and I figured that would give people a way to hear what the introduction is and what the conclusion is from her point of view instead of, if you don't want to read all 50 pages. But, so, ding, 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 have at it.
All right. So the most for people who don't understand, I assume almost everybody in your audience at least understands what happened in Doe's versus Snyder, which was a pretty big case that happened and went all the way to the Sixth Circuit and then was petitioned to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided not to take it, which means that essentially for the area of the Sixth Circuit, it is now the law of the land. Unfortunately, the state of Michigan, while they got the memo, did not then follow up by changing legislation or the way that they enforced it. And so as a result, the ACLU brought what a case that's called what we've been calling Doe's 2, which is a class action suit to make sure that all people who are affected by the ex post facto application of the law, and in essence, anyone who was sentenced before 20—anyone who was charged before 2011, at the date when the Adam Walsh Act came into effect, in essence, that all of them should get relief from the Doe's versus Snyder case. And right now, that case is in what's called pretrial settlement. And the thing we have not heard back from, I'm actually on one of the task forces that's related to that. And the thing we haven't heard back from yet was the AG. And so when we got that amicus yesterday, while it's not directly related to the Doe's 2 case, it does seem to suggest that the AG is essentially going to agree or not try to pursue a fight against the Doe's 2 case. We'll know for sure next week. But that means at the very baseline, at the floor, that we're probably going to at least have a situation where the courts will not be enforcing retroactive application of the Adam Walsh Act against people who were arrested before the date when that was enacted, which is pretty good news. I also think that part of the argument we've been making to the legislature here is that if that happens, if Doe's 2 wins, that's going to create a lot of nightmares for how the registry is enforced, because you have all these different groups of people who the registry is enforced on in different ways. And so the ACLU came up with a bunch of legislative fixes. This is going to create a lot of pressure, hopefully, on the legislature to actually enact the legislative fixes. And I think actually Dan Essel in the brief did a really good job of explaining a lot of the arguments that, like I've said for a very long time, that if you're not going to get rid of the registry, that what you really need to do is to allow the registry to graduate people off of it, to get rid of the part that allows essentially technical violations to become mandatory four-year felonies, get rid of in-person reporting, get rid of residency requirements, and you'd have at least and maybe risk assessments. I'm not a huge fan of that, but at least this is everything she said in the brief basically agrees with most of that, which is very exciting. And I think more important than maybe anything is it's the first time an attorney general that I know of in the United States has ever written an amicus brief or any kind of public statement really coming out against registration as it currently exists. And so to me, it's a fundamental challenge to the idea of registries as they exist now. And, you know, you got to remember an attorney general is the top law enforcement officer in the state. I mean, it's just astounding to me. I think a lot of us were just flabbergasted as we were reading it last night. I know it's 50 pages, but I probably read it three times. So, I mean, that's the short version, and you can certainly ask me more questions.
Let me circle back. Larry, can you give us a quick rundown of what that the Doe's 1 case would have been? That's the one that Miriam Aukerman worked on, right?
Well, it was the biggie. It was the first time where we had a circuit find that the registry as it exists today is putative, and it was an unexpected victory. They had achieved a victory on a different issue at the trial court level, and they had the ex post facto clause they had not won on, and it was a surprise. They had what they thought was a conservative panel of the three judge panel on the Court of Appeals, and that case, as Josh said, when the state got that decision, they petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear it. And the Michigan ACLU and the clinical law program that Paul Reingold headed up, I don't know if he's retired or not now, but they put a lot of hours into it, about $1.8 million worth of hours into fighting that. And they went to D.C. and met with the Solicitor General's office about why the Supreme Court should not hear the case. And the Solicitor General of the United States concurred that they should not hear the case, and they decided not to hear the case, which effectively made it the law of the land. And you could read more into it. You could read into it that the Supreme Court felt that they got it right. I don't read that much into it. I read into it that Michigan's sex offender registry is highly distinguishable from what's required by federal law. There's a lot of things in the Michigan law, the law that's not required by federal law, and the rather than running the risk of having the federal law under examination and scrutiny, it was a strategic decision to let the scrutiny be on Michigan's components of registration that have nothing to do with federal law. You can be compliant with that abolition and not do a lot of the stuff that Michigan got themselves in trouble doing. You don't have to have proximity restrictions. You don't have to have residential restrictions. You don't have to have employment restrictions. All those things are not required by federal law. So when you hate those, don't get mad at federal law. They're not in the federal law to start with. So the Solicitor General said, don't hear this case because all those things have nothing to do with federal law. And he attempted to contain the damage by saying that let's just keep it at a Sixth Circuit level.
Yeah, I was going to say, one thing I would clarify is that Michigan took the ball of the Adam Walsh Act and ran with it. So those things were, when I was saying Adam Walsh is the genesis of that, it's because Michigan then took that as an excuse to add all the rest of the stuff to the law.
Which probably all of the states have done. The specific thing that I want to get, though, is the reason why there is the Doe 2 case is because the Doe 1 case only applied to 5 or 6 plaintiffs?
Well, technically, anyone who went to court could use Doe's. Like, say that after Doe's versus Snyder, I got arrested on a violation for being for registering as a Tier 2, even though I was a Tier 3, which is factually correct. Then I could go to court and say, well, the reason I was only two is because Doe's said so, and the court might use Doe's as a reason to give me relief. But this ensures that is just that all people in the class that it would apply to, as opposed to just those 6 people.
And there are 40 whatever thousand people. It's the second, third, fourth largest registry in the country.
I think fourth, but our population, I mean, by percentage, it means we're a very large registry because our population is much lower. Yeah.
So I'm curious. I was semi-throwing some cold water on the whole thing. I was like, it's just another one of those things, and Larry's going to tear it apart. So did you have a chance to read it, though, Larry?
I did not read the entire thing. I was concur with Josh that it is a first. I mean, it's the one of those darn liberal do-good attorney generals elected, and we don't need those kind of people around here. But for a stipulation from the eight, that's essentially, from what I did read, is essentially a stipulation that the legislature blew it and they went too far. And a lot of jargon that I use, it was in the brief, and I don't appreciate people not giving me credit for what I've been saying for all these years.
When Guy and I were talking about this last one of those times when you're reading one of the late law review articles from the new but brilliant law student who's saying everything you've always wanted to do, you know, only it was from someone with power. <It's>...
when people keep saying that the Supreme Court ratified and sanctioned and approved anything, they did not do that. They did just the opposite of that. They said, we're grudgingly going to allow this registration scheme to stand because, and I always harp on disabilities of restraint, of the 7 factors that they use to determine if a regulatory scheme is punitive, the biggest one, in my view, that was pivotal in that case, it wouldn't have a damn thing to do with your recidivism. That is not what decided the case, although there's people out there who would love to believe that. It was built on the fact that Alaska didn't impose any prohibitions, and all they did required you to send in a form. And they equated that with renewing various forms of licensure, and they said, this is not punitive in our view. So therefore, we can't hold it punitive. It is an ex post facto application, but it can only be a violation of ex post facto if it imposes punishment. It does not. Therefore, it stands. But they didn't say you go do anything you want to. And I'm glad to see people finally putting that in briefs, because that's the reality of the situation. You can't do anything you want to do, but you can do a regulatory scheme. And Michigan can go back and they can bring all the people that have gotten off back on the registry if they want to. If they're inclined to, if they want to do a misguided public policy, as long as they have a regulatory scheme that doesn't impose punishment.
That is correct.
Well, I wanted to leave a significant amount of time for us to cover this, so feel free.
I don't encourage them to do that because it's a misguided policy, and the AG just told them that in the brief. But if they wanted to, if they wanted to say, okay, we got the message, we're going to have a registry, you'll mail us a form once a year, you'll come in every 3 years to update your photo, and you can live wherever you want to, you can work wherever you want to, and possibly take your home address off the internet and maybe just have your city, that would probably be constitutional. I don't advocate for it, but it would probably fall within a zone of constitutionality.
Well, and I think there's a good chance that we'll end up with something like that. I think the four pillars of what the ACLU have been asking for are get rid of the public nature of the registry, allow people a way to graduate off, which would make it, I think, much better for almost everybody. What were the other two pillars? I think you just mentioned them. I'm spacing for some reason, but basically, I don't remember. But anyway,
it's the constant reporting.
Recording.
Talked about that being a form of probation super, but I can take that out. I can say, okay, you don't have to come anymore. You mail me a form. We'll send you a form once a year and you return it. And tell us that you confirmed that you live there. Okay, I've got rid of the in-person reporting. So therefore, it's no more like probation. I take your home address off the internet. You complain about that you might have a projectile coming through your window. Well, we don't reveal your address anymore, so there's no projectile coming through your window anymore because nobody knows how to find you. They just know that you live in Grand Rapids. I would like to see the internet. I'd like to see the internet go away. But I'm saying if you're trying to dance around and find out what you could do, that would be what I would do if I were representing Michigan. I'd say, well, we got to stop the in-person reporting. We've got to not tell them where they can live. We've got to not restrict where they can work. And we've got to make sure we don't do anything that resembles punishment. So that means we can't charge them any fees. Well, when you start taking all those things out of it, it kind of defeats the purpose because the people that want registries, they're enjoying the punishment and humiliation. If you're coming in every 90 days or every 30 days or every 10 days, if you're homeless, they're enjoying the humiliation. And if they can no longer humiliate you, the thrill of having a registry will largely abate.
Well, that's an interesting point, but I do think it's very likely, and I think really important, is that it is very likely, I think, that Michigan's registry is going to substantially change in a way that provides a counterpoint to the rest of the country. And I think the important thing is going to be if recidivism rates stay low after that happens. I know the media is going to go crazy every time there is a recidivism incident, but if the recidivism rates stay low after the changes happen, it's going to make a fairly strong case, I think, against the rest of the country in a lot of ways.
I would say on an intellectual level, it will. On an emotional level, it won't. People, the facts don't matter when it comes to emotional decisions. And this is driven by emotion.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I do think, however, that, you know, the long process we've been going through of changing this demonstrates that there is at least a core of people who are committed to the idea that evidence and reason matters. And while that doesn't always dominate, especially in the moment, it seems to be starting to win the day. I think when she starts the brief by saying that the times are changing or whatever she said, that's what she's talking about.
Well, this is a fantastic, fantastic brief from what I read.
Oh, one other thing I want to say about the brief real quick. I know you're going to have other, but one of the things I thought was really remarkable is that with the exception of referring to the sex offender registry, she went out of her way to never even remotely call us sex offenders. Whenever she referred to people, she might talk about people who are required to register or some other, but she would very rarely, I don't think if ever, say, refer to the people who are on the registry as sex offenders, which I thought for for a law enforcement official was pretty amazing.
What about this trickling across the 49 or 72 states, whatever we have at this current count, the rest of the United States? What does it take for this to have any sort of movement to go to the other states?
I'll let Larry say something about that first. I'm sure he has something.
It's going to take what I would, if I had all the resources that we need and would want, I would like to start building this out. And I would start within the Sixth Circuit, of course, because as Josh said, it's the law of the circuit. So I'd start trying to knock down as much as I can in the Sixth Circuit, and you build momentum by doing that. And contemporaneously with doing that if we can build our legislative advocacy on a state-by-state basis, you begin to try to do some strong legislative advocacy, which is to you begin with stopping things from getting worse. There's always proposals all over the country right now. There's proposals to make registration worse. In Arkansas, they were considering a Halloween restriction, which I think is dead for the moment. But you would, if you build up your legislative advocacy, you stop the freight train from getting worse, and then you begin to have a dialogue with people about how that the case law is not in your favor, and you refer to briefs like this and hopefully more additional wins that you pick up in the Sixth Circuit, where you're almost certain to win if the registry is within the Sixth Circuit or punitive. And then you try to build out additional litigation in other states, relying on the Sixth Circuit as though it's not binding. You use that as persuasive authority when you compare your registration requirements outside the Sixth Circuit to the requirements in the Sixth Circuit that were stricken, and you point to that very fine analysis of the Sixth Circuit, and you say, although this is not binding to you guys here, this is very persuasive, this is fine analysis, and you get more circuits on board, and eventually the Supreme Court will decide to revisit the case when there's enough circuits. There's already quite a list of state Supreme Courts that have said this is no longer the case, Smith versus Doe is no longer relevant. When you start having multiple circuit courts saying this is Smith versus Doe is no longer relevant, the Supreme Court is eventually not going to be rendered uncounted, and they're eventually going to take a dispute at some point in time and say, here are the boundaries of what you can do with a so-called regulatory scheme. So that's what I'd like to see happen, is a combination of more litigation, more legislative advocacy.
Well, and I think there's also kind of one of the things that's really, I think, remarkable about now, Corey Rayburn has said that he feels like she was a little bit put in a box. Dana Nessel was put in a box by the situation between the Sixth Circuit and the Doe's 2 case. And that may very well be true. She's above and beyond in her reasoning in the brief. So I feel like she's to some extent on our side based on some of the things that were said in the brief. However, I think it's really important to remember the political courage it took for her to put this out. I don't think, part of the thing that I've never seen before from an AG, I just have never seen anyone willing to stand up who is that powerful. And she's going to get backlash on this. There's no doubt about it. She had to know that. She had to prepare for it. And once someone has the courage to do that, if she makes it through this and the law changes and things change, other people are going to have more courage to do it. I've seen it in every other area of criminal justice reform. So sometimes it takes that one person who's willing to kind of stand up, who has the power to stand up and do something like this. And hopefully that means other people will soon too.
You're absolutely correct about that, Josh. That is exactly the way politics works. Politicians are like snakes in the grass, and not the way that people are hearing that. They lay low and they wait to see if somebody sticks their neck up, if it gets chopped off. And if it doesn't get chopped off, then you can watch it if you're astute enough to watch voting. If you go to committee meetings and watch a vote take place, when you see a lawmaker pass, when the clerk calls the roll in a committee, and a lawmaker passes, that lawmaker is passing because he's waiting, he or she's waiting to see how the vote's going and if they're going to be isolated. So if the clerk calls the roll and your name starts with A and you say, I pass, they want to see where things are headed. And absolutely, if this attorney general manages to survive this, luckily she's in her first few days in office, just got elected in 2018, and hopefully this will be old news, and she'll been able to put away enough payday lenders and whatever her priorities are for consumer protections and things that attorney general gets a lot of credit for, that this won't be a big part of the reelection. But if it turns out to be a part of the reelection, and if somebody who was on the registry offends again and it's vilified, it could have the opposite effect. It could make sure that people say, well, I won't go down the path what this crazy woman did.
Well, I think it's inevitable that someone will reoffend again. And I think one of the arguments that we need to be careful to make in all of our, everyone who's legislative lobbying, things like that, we really need to start being able to articulate the difference between someone recidivating and overall recidivism rates increasing or decreasing, and make that in a persuasive way. In this particular case, really what I want to say, I think Larry's exactly right, but 5 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that the president of the United States would invite four formerly incarcerated people, some for who were in prison for violent crimes, some who were in for crack cocaine, after they've been released early to be his guests at a State of the Union. And I think it's just as astounding that an attorney general got up and said, not only do I think that the Michigan Sex Offender Registry is a little bad, I think it's really got some serious problems. You know, I hope she does survive. And I think this was a really important moment.
It is. And I'm very happy to see Michigan hopefully turning the corner, because the things that they were doing there, when they souped up the registry, particularly in 2011, I said, this is awful. You know, this is totally awful. And then here we are 8 years later, finally, it looks like that we're moving towards a resolution of those horrible changes they made.
There's a bunch of information in the PDF that, I mean, it's well sourced and well cited. Two things. One, there's no way that this was produced within her month in office or so. And more so than that, with all the sightings and everything that's in there, this is an incredible framework for people to use to have, if they're going to go to the legislature and talk about anything, that this has like links and references to all the things that you need for your talking points to say that policy A or B is bad.
One thing I want to draw particular attention to is she makes an argument. I personally think the last argument, the last desperate gasp of the people who are tough on registrants in terms of the evidence is the argument for underreporting. I don't think personally it's a very strong argument, but people are very persuaded by it. She makes a very smart argument at the end of the brief about underreporting and uses statistics, well, uses evidence to back it up that suggests that the registration actually increases underreporting, which is, I think it's really good to have a toolkit full of arguments against underreporting, because it's the one they always go to when you go, well, you're wrong on all the on all the other stuff. They'll go, oh, but, you know, most people aren't, you know, underreporting, you know, that's what they always go to. It's like their go-to.
Well, that is correct. And as far as the brief, Andy, she didn't have anything to do with writing this. This was something that was produced. If you look at the signature by Fadwa Hammoud and Ann Sherman, the Solicitor General and the Assistant Solicitor General, she might not even know it was even filed. But it's under her name because she's the Attorney General. But she never
put out a press release with her name, so she definitely knew what. I mean, you don't put out a press release unless you, as Dana Dessel, right,
well,
unless you're going to.
Well, she was told that we got this press release. Do you object? But just peripherally, that's all she knows about this. I mean, she's not micromanaging this case. I can guarantee you. There's hundreds of people working in the AG's office, and I doubt even Mr. Fadwa actually wrote the thing himself. They've got legal scholars there working in the AG's office. They gave the approval for it, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, she had to know that she was taking this position and she had to sign off of it, because the political consequences would be too big on something like this for her not to be.
But like I said, she didn't write the brief, but she does. No. She is comfortable with the position. So I'd like to meet Fadwa.
Maybe you can have him as a guest next time, or her. I don't know.
So I don't know if Fadwa is a male or female.
No idea.
Who would know these things? Is there anything else that you want to throw out there before we close this out?
I think this is a great day to be alive, Andy. People always wondering, progress is being made. Progress is being made. Thousands of people in the near future are going to get some relief in Michigan, and that's a good thing.
Let me ask you this question. On a scale of 1 to 10, you know, 10 being like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever, the registry's taken down, where does this fit?
Well, for me, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, this is as big to me as Windows versus Snyder came down, because of just the symbolic impact, if nothing else, and because I think it's probably going to mean that DOES actually gets enforced for all registrants who it applied to, which is a pretty huge deal. I think there might be even a lot more. It might actually result in a different kind of registry than most states have right now, which is astounding to me. I think when I got out, that was inconceivable to me. So,
well, Josh, do you have any idea how they will deal with the people that have convictions that predate 2011 and they move to Michigan afterwards? Oklahoma took the interesting tack. They said, well, the ex post facto applies only if you were here prior to our decision. But we're going to look at when you subject the analytical framework is when you subject yourself to registration in Oklahoma. So if you move to Oklahoma now, too bad, you don't benefit from Starkey. But I wonder what they'll do when there's all these U-Hauls headed to Michigan are people who have older convictions and they're living under the bridges in Florida and they want to get this new modern registry in Michigan. Why do you think that's going to play out for people without out-of-state convictions?
I think sadly, and you know probably more about this legally than I do, understanding is the state of conviction is what governs your, the state of original conviction is what governs how you're treated. And so I think that that might be a loophole in the sense that Michigan might not have to recognize it except for people who were charged in Michigan. I could be wrong about that. That would be my guess. It would suck. I hope you're right that it, you know, I know everyone's always afraid of state A or state B becoming a haven and everyone's going to move here. And maybe that's true. And I hope, I mean, I actually, in this case, would be okay with that because, you know, these are my people. But, I suspect that there might be that loophole. Do you think that's correct, Larry?
I really don't, unless Michigan law says so, because regular listeners have heard this a dozen times before, but it's like when you move your car from the arid sunny west where we don't worry about pollution, and you take it to New Jersey where they have a compact when you have a huge population per square mile. The fact that you don't have to register it here doesn't mean you don't have to a smog inspection it there. Well, unless the state specifically says you're governed by your state of conviction, you're governed by the state of the registry laws of the state you move to. The conviction is no longer relevant. If Florida says you're lifetime and you go to Vermont, you're 10 years, you're 10 years. Unless Vermont says
except if you then leave Vermont and go back. I see what you're saying, and that does make sense to me.
Some states have taken that posture that we required. Utah is the first one that comes to my mind, is that they say we require you to register for 10 years or the time required your convicting state, which mm-hmm. is longer.
So I guess I'll have to think about that and ask around. I suspect that my hope would be that they don't figure that out until after we finish doing.
Well, since I'm not the brightest bulb in the socket, I can guarantee if I can think of it, someone else can.
Yeah, well, in that case, I'm going to start thinking about that one for sure.
I suspect that if Michigan comes up with a good registry, there will. I don't know what the deluge would be, but why wouldn't you go there? If you have a chance of getting off and you have no chance of getting off, who in their right mind would stay in a state where they're going to be oppressed versus a state where they can get off? You'd be insane to continue to stay there.
But wasn't that the case in New Mexico for a while? Wasn't that one of the fear, or didn't you all for a while there, it was kind of set up that way. Is that not correct?
Well, it's still not set up that way. Okay. You have to be covered by our registry law. We don't have a law that says just because you have to register somewhere, you have to register here.
No.
Have to have.
Yeah. I was just meaning that you had kind of a more lenient law in New Mexico for a while. Did that end up becoming a haven in a sense, or?
Well, it depends on who you ask. According to the state people, it is a haven. People move here all the time that have older convictions. If they're too old, we don't care. If you were off paper by July 1, 1995, you don't have to register here, regardless of what your sex offense is, regardless of what the other state says. Well, that's not something that hundreds and thousands of people come here, but people do come here. And that when they're dumb enough to tell them, what they do is they say, why did you move to New Mexico? Well, I did the research on New Mexico law, and I don't think I have to register here. And they put that on a tally sheet. And what you tell them is, I got a job here and I moved here because I like the climate. But they run that and tell them, well, I don't think I'm going to have to register here. and then they use that as their argument that there's a magnet of people coming here. I don't know what the total is, but people do. But I'm saying, why wouldn't you? You'd be crazy not to if you had the option. Some people are stuck for various reasons, but if you have the freedom, if you have an income stream and you can live anywhere, why would you choose to have projectiles coming in your windows and people picketing outside your house? Why would you choose that when you could live someplace where you wouldn't have that?
I would try to answer that, but I don't really know if there is an answer to that one, Larry.
Well, but I'm saying if you have the option, some people don't have the option. you know, they're caring for a sick loved one. Their job is there. They could never get another job that pays anything like that. They're in love with someone, and they could never leave their loved one because my spouse won't leave here. We grew up here, and we went to high school together, and all the relatives are here, and for various reasons, they won't leave. But if you have the option, well, I think you'd be really nuts not to. If the registry is as bad as what people say it is, and I do believe it is as bad as what people say it is, why would you not want to extract yourself from that if you could?
Absolutely.
So now we should get some email for that one. But
well, Josh, I so very much appreciate you coming in and giving us the lowdown from the local point of view. How can people find you on the Twitter, on your website? What's your podcast? What's your book? Tell us all about that stuff.
All right. Well, the first thing I'll say is for those of you who have you all talked about Untouchable before on here, the documentary?
I totally keep forgetting to bring it up that it's available on all the streaming sites, but go ahead and tell us.
Yeah. Well, David, my guest this week on Decarceration Nation's going to be Vega, who was the director of the documentary. So I'm pretty excited about that. You can find that at decarcerationnation.com. It'll be up on Monday. The Twitter is just my name, Josh, at Joshua B. Ho. And the book, I've never really plugged the book before, but it's a book about addiction and recovery, and you can find it on my website or at Amazon under my name.
Awesome. Well, Larry, let's go through this whole thing. How can people find us?
They're going to have to look very hard.
Really hard? How hard?
Well, if they I think if they Google Registry Matters, it would take them right there, wouldn't it?
It totally would. I did it just a little while ago, and it's the number one link. So yeah, you can rest assured that you will find it. And I even checked Bing because someone brought it up, and I was like, what is Bing? But yes, it'll show up there too.
I was about to say, or any search engine, but particularly Google, but Bing would probably do it, and you say it does. But if you don't want to Google it, you can just go to registrymatters.co.
I don't know if this is true for you all, but I got told by Apple that someone could say to Siri just the name of your podcast, and it would start playing. I don't know if that's true or not.
Oh, I totally, yeah, you can do it on the Echo device. I don't want to say the word, the A word, because then it'll start saying. But yeah, you can totally listen to the podcast on all of the smart speakers, too. I don't really plug that very often, but I was really excited when I got it to do it.
Yeah, I guess mine is there, too. It just seems like, I guess people do that. I don't have one of those things.
So, but now, if you don't use the internet, because you're forbidden, and you want to talk to us, you can actually use an old-fashioned phone. And
what?
If you have a rotary phone, you have like a little circular dial, and you would dial 747-227-4477. And if you're more modern, you have buttons, then you would push those buttons, 747-227-4477.
Man, y'all are old school.
Well, people used to dial phones, for heaven's sakes.
I remember rotary phones. I'm not young.
Just, if you're more modern. All right. How can they email us, Larry?
And if you are allowed to use the internet, you can send us an email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
What is the absolute best way to support and show your love for the podcast?
Oh, that's the thing that I think I said two or three weeks ago is you look at the amount that you bring home on your check and the net pay. And then you go to Patreon, and I'm being funny here, patreon.com/registrymatters, and you take that amount and you put that in as the monthly contribution.
Outstanding. Right on.
Man, if that works, I got a bout of that.
So actually, you can put in any amount if you're inclined, starting at, I think, a dollar is the minimum amount.
Yes. A dollar a month would be awesome to show the support.
And we're trying to build numbers of patrons. So if you can afford a dollar, there's something magic's going to happen when we reach a certain level. And Andy has explained it to me, but we're not there yet. When we get a certain number, it's kind of like the YouTube channel. When we got 100, we're going to get some magic recognition when we reach a certain number of supporters. So if you can afford a dollar, that'd be fantastic.
Absolutely.
And if you can afford more, we'd like that as well.
Of course. You know, it is sort of like a side subject, but in about 36 or so episodes, we hit 100, so we have to figure out what kind of big celebration to do in 30-something episodes.
So, well, we'll figure out something.
All right.
We can have a party on the on the podcast. And then what something about Discord here. What is that all about? How does that work?
Yeah, well, Discord is the platform. We have about a bunch of people that come in and talk about it. There are people listening. There are people asking questions. And helps, you know, I submit show topics. People send topics in there. It's a really great place to hang out and be in a friendly environment with people of like minds.
Do we have any people in Discord tonight?
We do. We have a typical crazy person from Kentucky. And then we also have someone kind of special from Maryland. Should I unmute the person from Maryland?
You should delete that person from the server.
Say hi real quick, Brenda.
I resemble that remark.
Very well. And you are Brenda Jones, the executive director of Narsal, correct?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Did you enjoy our discussions tonight?
I certainly did. It was nice listening to everybody.
So, well, we hope we entertained. And informed.
Thank you, everybody, and have a great night. I will talk to y'all soon.
Bye.
All right. Bye, guys.